There are few people today who doubt that China is a global superpower, both militarily and economically. In terms of the economy, China's economy has continued to grow over the past few decades and is well on its way to overtake the U.S.'s by the year 2030. In terms of military and technology, China is now a superpower on par with the U.S., although Washington's military budget is still the largest in the world. Politicians in Washington who are still dreaming of a unipolar world order that came into existence following the collapse of the Soviet Union do not tolerate the rise of China. The first sign of the unease began to emerge after the former U.S. President Barack Obama announced his pivot to Asia policy, which was meant to counter China's rising influence. Obama's successors, Trump and Biden, have continued Washington's anti-China rhetoric. The two superpowers are locked over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea. The bone of contention is Chinese Taipei, and Beijing has made it very clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to become independent.
It really can only be averted at this point by the nations of the West recognizing that they have no solution to the now terminal breakdown of the dollar system, the hyperinflationary collapse, other than sitting down with Russia and with China in a new Bretton Woods conference to replace the now completely broken and destroyed Bretton Woods system that was set up by Franklin Roosevelt and has been systemically taken apart over these last 30 years.
Chinese Taipei is under China's sovereignty and under the One China policy. The United States and other countries have recognized that sovereignty. But Washington, in violation of its own stated policy, and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, has increased diplomatic contact with the Chinese Taipei.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station Choo Choo Kachoo. It's the Youth Station for you.
Yes, of course, and I'm here. This is Asma. You're listening to IRIB English Radio.
This is Asma. It's good to have you. And this is Mudathir. So for youths connecting to Imam Hussein, I'd say it's a lot more difficult than it is for adults to understand.
Why? I don't have the same idea.
You don't? Okay, no. Let me explain why I think that. Because, number one, I remember when I was a youth, and it was very difficult for me to connect to Imam Hussein. I did not understand the concept at all. Astaghfirullah, I'm sorry to say it like this, but yeah, this is how I felt genuinely when I was a kid.
It's okay to share your experiences with us.
He was a great warrior, and he, you know, he was killed a long time ago. How is that relevant today? So I think the key there is relevancy. Uh-huh. What makes Imam Hussein relevant? Okay, all of you people are crying for him. The second thing is, for youths, it's difficult to cry for somebody else's pain. You're inherently more selfish when you're younger.
Yeah.
You don't have that level of empathy for somebody else's grief or somebody else's worry. You just care about yourself.
Yes.
Thirdly, because of the interrelationships, I just invented a word, the relationships that Imam Hussein alayhi salam has with others, for example, with his daughter Sakina, mm-hmm, salam Allah alayha, with his brother Abbas, with his wife, with his other child,
yeah,
Ayun al-Asghar alayhi salam. I mean, for an adult, you can understand that through your own relationships,
yes,
now, because you have children,
said,
you have a spouse, etc.
Mm-hmm.
For a child, though,
yeah.
You know, I hated my brother when I was a kid. I was like, if he dies, good. If he died, I hate him.
Oh, my God.
Kids are like that,
they don't
right?
seem like that.
Yeah, I don't seem like that. No, I mean, that's how I was. Okay, it's different for boys and girls, I think. So
yes.
It might be slightly different.
Girls are more passionate and kind, I suppose.
It might be also a Western phenomenon where you have even more of an increase in that,
maybe, yes.
Selfishness and stuff.
Yes, maybe even about the things that you were saying regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, I would say that it has to do something with the culture you brought up with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because as for me, based on my personal experience, I would say that it is easier for the youth because I have been growing in a society in which ever since I was a child, I went through those gatherings and uh-huh. we enjoyed in those gatherings in a way that we have a Lord that we are serving him. And we were so much satisfied with every step we took that we're going to be rewarded. And we thought that he is going to have an eye on us. And, you know, a sort of friendship starts to happen between you and him. And also we have it that he is the Lord of the youth in heaven.
Yeah, he's
so. But his relationship yeah. with youth, we have been told that it has been so phenomenal and so just like very incredible.
Yeah.
So I guess for youth, has got much more of purity in their heart. If they think too much about him, if they ponder about the way he lived and the way he looked at every single creature, and specifically the youth.
Well, I think there's. A big difference between what I said and what you said because of the cultural difference.
Exactly, yes.
Sister, you were raised in Iran, right? Which
yes,
city?
Yes, yes, I was raised in Iran. Yes.
Okay,
I had the blessing to grow up in here.
Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah.
Of course.
Now, I was also in a Shia environment where every Muharram, everything would be black, no
yes.
TV. You know, we had
still,
these basic
a school rules. And other parts of life would have an effect on you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But even when I did go to the majalis, they were in a foreign language. They were in Urdu.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand a lot of what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you have to bear in mind, in Qom, you had the Inqilab, the revolution, the Islamic revolution. Actually, it woke up the masses to actually look at the concept of Imam Hussein in a completely different light.
Yeah.
It was suddenly relevant. This is about the sacrifice that you can make. And so that is like a trickle-down effect. It affected everybody in society.
Exactly.
Where the way that we commemorate Imam Hussein was given a proper direction. Sister, in the UK, when I was growing up, it had no direction. You know, people would cry. They would
yeah.
cry a lot, and that's great. But why? You know, what
yes,
is the purpose?
That question has not been answered to you as a youth.
Never.
So now, since you have been there, had that experience, what should be done for a person as the age that you were already talking about of your experience? What should we do to that person to make him understand that question that you had in your mind? Why? Why should I cry for a person who was good? Okay,
yeah.
It was good and it was only for
yeah,
him.
Yeah. The first thing, yeah, a very good question and a loaded question as well. The first thing is to make it relevant.
Mm-hmm.
For goodness sake, why did he make that sacrifice? And what does that have to do with me as a youth? Right, it might sound like a huge burden that you're putting on the youth.
Yeah.
But actually, they want to be heroes. There is no young boy,
yeah.
right, who doesn't want to be a warrior.
Yes.
Right, so you tell him that, look, because Imam Hussein only had 72 plus companions with him, you know, but they still charged into the battlefield for the sake of Islam. You have to be a warrior for the sake of Islam. You have to walk in the footsteps of Abbas alayhi salam
mm-hmm.
For the Hussein of your time, for Imam Mahdi. So immediately you've given them that sense of relevancy,
yeah.
right? And the sacrifice of Imam Hussein shows you the level of sacrifice that you need to be willing and ready to make. The second point about making it relevant is you cannot avoid the Islamic revolution. The Islamic Revolution is precisely that which has given direction to the not just the concept of Imam Hussein in Karbala, but
it's actually practicing the lessons of Ashura.
Asant, exactly. In the West, the phenomenon that's unfolding now is in their attempt to make Hussein alayhi salam relevant for the youths, they've turned him into a Jesus Christ figure.
Yes.
Cry for him, you're going to go to Jannah. And so everybody thanks a lot. Thank you for contributing to Islam.
It's not just about crying. You have to practice what he has given you as lessons.
So if you want to make it relevant, the revolution is the way to make it relevant. Otherwise, it's just irrelevant. It's always
going to be irrelevant. You give them a recent example of Ashura in order to make it relevant for them. That's what you mean, right?
Yeah.
So what more about the character of Imam Hussein alayhi salam that we should focus on to the youth is actually...
every part of his personality,
yes, of
really,
course.
Isn't it?
The way he stood for justice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nowadays, all people are searching for justice, but they cannot see it everywhere.
Yeah.
But we have this example in front of us that has been a kind man who had a heart of gold, and at the very same time, he was so firm and stood strongly against the tyrant of his age.
Mm-hmm. We've been discussing how to make Imam Hussein alayhi salam relevant for the youths, but now we're going to talk about something slightly different, which is what about when your questions are answered, but in the wrong way?
Oh, okay.
So I want to paint a picture of what's happening, especially a phenomenon that I see unfolding in the Western world, is the whitewashing of Imam Hussein in Karbala.
Yes.
It's where you take away the element of fighting for the sake of Islam, the jihadi element of it.
Oh, yes.
And you just make it into, oh, yeah, he was just there for peace. He was just there. And you'll see posters, for example, of Gandhi.
Yeah.
Gandhi will have a quote, and right next to it, you'll have a quote of Imam Hussein, as though they're the same, as though everything that they were fighting for was exactly the same.
Yes.
You have Martin Luther King, you have Imam Hussein, and you'll say, these two are basically the same.
Yeah.
They were both fighting for human rights. And
so
while
is it
Imam,
a sort of lowering the importance of what he did?
So they're doing it with good intentions, right? They're doing it for the purpose of introducing Imam Hussein to the Western world and also to show the Western world that, look, just like you have these heroes like Gandhi and Martin Luther King, you also should add Imam Hussein to the list of those heroes.
Yes.
Because he was fighting for human rights and all those things that you like, freedom, etc. But that's actually
not true.
You know, it's completely detracting
from
a huge part of what Imam Hussein was there to fight for.
Yes.
He was there to fight for Islam.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Just as we are going through those mornings, it's not just a situation in which you go, sit for a little while, shed some tears, and then get out of it and the story is finished. No, you have to ponder upon it and go closer to the exact meanings that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was looking for.
Yeah.
Actually, we should act like the messengers of his lessons to other cultures and nations. And we can even start it from our small circles of friends or whomever that are around us. We talk to them about the truth behind Ashura, actually.
See, okay, so a lot of it is to do with standing up against the tyrant of the time.
Yeah.
Yes. It is a revolt.
Yes, that was the point.
Imam Hussein revolted against the tyrannical king of his time. Imam was there, if for some reason Allah placed him there, he would not hesitate to rise up against that evil, tyrannical government. Now, to paint him in the same light as, for example, Martin Luther King and Gandhi, it's so unfair. So, okay, it's not just about crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, listening to poetry about Imam Hussein, creating artwork to do with Imam Hussein. All of that is important and you should do all of those things as well. But the most important thing is stepping on the path of Imam Hussein.
Yes, and which very is very difficult.
Right.
Of course.
But for youths, you need to start this now. What do I mean by now? I am encountering more and more adults who are afraid to speak up when it comes to the big things. For example, for Palestine, for example, for Yemen, for example, for Iran. They won't do it. They're scared of doing it. Especially when you have role models like Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who sacrificed everything for the truth.
Yeah.
Allah shows you any form of injustice taking place.
Mm-hmm.
You need to speak up against it.
Because that's a test for you.
It might be that you see a thief running away from a shop. It might be one of your good friends.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to stand up against your own friend when he's doing something
bad. Of course, yes. And do not act as though things that are happening around you are just immaterial to you.
Mm-mm, no.
Don't be like that.
So
neutral to what is going around
Absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, yeah.
You have to have a word of your own self.
If you don't build that heroic personality from now and you just remain neutral, you're going to be like that until the end.
Exactly.
And you're going to end up like the people of Kufa. That's what they were, neutral.
Oh,
I'm going to stay
God.
Out of this.
That's very bad.
Right? I'm going to stay out of this. I'm not going to side with Imam Hussein. I'm not going to side with Yazid. And you ended up, because the people of Kufa didn't take any side, they didn't take the right side, they ended up on the wrong side.
And usually those who side with the wrong side buy their freedom and safety without thinking about anything else.
Just their freedom and safety.
So it's a kind of selfishness.
It's completely selfishness.
So what actually Imam Hussein alayhi salam did was a sort of sacrificing himself to show us that he was not selfish and thinking about only himself and his family. He stood up against the tyrannical figures of the time.
Yeah.
And he was just giving in everything. Actually, is another side that we should take care of. So thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. You are listening to Arab English Radio. This is Youth Station. And I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you. Thank you for listening.
We bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
New documentary discloses the ways Western publics are softened up for aggressive global U.S. militarism through the Defense Department's influence over thousands of U.S. films and TV shows. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jonathan Quick, author. This article is published under the heading How the Pentagon Dictates Hollywood Storylines. Here's the second part. The Pentagon has been particularly sensitive to portrayals of the U.S. military following a fiasco in 1993 in which one of its helicopters was downed in Mogadishu. That led to a prolonged firefight that killed more than a dozen U.S. soldiers and hundreds of Somalis. The following year, the U.S. Defense Department insisted on major revisions to the Harrison Ford vehicle Clear and Present Danger, especially in a scene where a Colombian militia overwhelms U.S. Special Forces. As documents unearthed by Theatrics of War show, U.S. officials worried that the Mogadishu events had made the U.S. military look ridiculous, and officials refused to cooperate in a movie that does the same thing in a different combat zone. It demanded changes to make the film more of a commercial for Americans. When in 2001 Hollywood turned its attention to the book Black Hawk Down, specifically about the Mogadishu incident, the Pentagon insisted on heavy script changes that transformed the drama. Just 8 years after the actual events depicted, the U.S. Defense Department had turned a story of its own incompetence into an all-American tale of military valor in the face of overwhelming odds at the hands of savage, faceless enemy. The Pentagon has such sway over Hollywood that it has been managed to turn around the anti-war message at the heart of a monster movie staple, Godzilla. Back in 1950s, it was an allegory about the horrors unleashed by the U.S. dropping nuclear bombs on Japan at the end of the Second World War. But in the 2014 version, the U.S. Defense Department meddling meant a reference to Hiroshima was excised and Cold War dynamics introduced instead. A lost nuclear submarine triggers a confrontation with Godzilla. Even more astonishingly, in both the 2014 and 2019 versions, the story is switched 180 degrees. Nuclear weapons become mankind's salvation rather than a threat, the only possible way Godzilla can be destroyed. Nuclear proliferation sponsored by the Pentagon is no longer a problem. In Godzilla, it is integral to human survival. Theatrics of War also makes a plausible case that the Pentagon has been an important driver behind Hollywood's movie into science fiction and fantasy territory. The imaginary worlds of the Marvel Universe, for example, offer a pristine showcase, demonstrating the need for the Pentagon's shiniest weapons against implacable otherworldly foes. Hollywood and the Pentagon can sweep aside real-world concerns, like the value of human life, the commercial motives behind wars, and the battlefield failures of military planners. The challenge of superhuman enemies with superhuman powers has proved the perfect way to normalize extravagant, ballooning military expenditures. That is why the Pentagon regularly insists on product placement rewrites, such as the incredible Hulk riding an F-22 in the 2003 Hulk film, Superman flying alongside an F-35 in 2013's Man of Steel, and the glorification of a ripsaw armored vehicle in 2017's 8th installment of the Fast and Furious franchise. Theatrics of War concludes that the promotion of U.S. militarism pays dividends. It meant bigger budgets for the Pentagon and its contractors, greater prestige, less oversight and scrutiny, more wasteful wars, and more profiteering. Donald Baruch, the Pentagon's special assistant for audiovisual media, has noted that the U.S. government couldn't buy the sort of publicly filmed gave-ups. In laundering the U.S. military's image, Hollywood encourages not only Western publics, but the Pentagon itself to believe its own type. It leaves the U.S. military more confident in its powers, less critically aware of its vulnerabilities, and more eager to wage war, even on the flimsiest of pretexts. With Hollywood's stamp of approval, the Pentagon also gets to define who are the bad guys. With Hollywood's stamp of approval, yes, the Pentagon gets to define who are the bad guys, as Theatrics of War says. And as Theatrics of War convincingly argues, the Pentagon's covert influence over popular culture can have a decisive role in raising support for divisive wars, such as the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. It can make the difference between public approval and rejection. How different things might be if Hollywood was ring-fenced from Pentagon influence is illustrated by a case study. The day after was a 1983 Cold War film made for US TV over Defense Department objections. The Pentagon rejected the script after it depicted a nuclear exchange between US and Russia following a series of misunderstandings. According to Theatrics of War, the U.S. Defense Department demanded that Moscow be squarely blamed for starting the fictional war. Unusually, the filmmakers held their ground. The day after was watched by nearly half the U.S. population. The president at the time, Ronald Reagan, recorded in his daily diary that the film had left him greatly depressed. It created political momentum that drew forward nuclear disarmament talks. A single film that stepped outside the Pentagon's simple-minded U.S. good guy narrative generated a debate about whether the use of nuclear weapons could ever be justified. The day after was widely credited with the slowing down the build-up of the two military superpowers' nuclear arsenals. And it treated Russians not simply as a foe, but as people facing the same existential threat from the bomb as ordinary Americans. In a small way, the day after made the world a safer place. Theatrics of War leaves audiences with a question. What might have been possible had the Pentagon not meddled in 3,000 movies and TV shows to promote its pro-war messages?
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the lifestyle of Imam Hussein. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio, and I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, in today's lesson, we want to talk about a very important personality, and that is Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who was the grandson of the Prophet. Now, as I'm talking about his lifestyle, I would like to portray in a few words the introduction. I would like to give a short introduction about this particular human being, this particular personality that indeed is a personality that brought change in the aspects of people's life, that brought change in the lives of the people that he lived with during his era. Now, in the history of Islam, there was no one more than Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam who has benefited Islam and bestowed its kindness and merits. Because His Eminence, alayhi salam, is the savior and the revivalist of this great religion, whom the Umayyad politics attacked and injured, and on the other hand, put obstacles in his path. Now, their internal and external discords were of such a level that there was no one who could save the people from destruction. Now, they were absolutely helpless, and nothing remained in their society to oppose or to resist or to protest against. The operations of the tyrannical rulers, in other words, were such that these people could not stand against them. The people could not say no to them. The people could not say, we have had enough. And there was no one who could help them from this particular situation. And in other words, the ruler has clearly announced to his subject that there was no religion, there was no Islam, no revelation, and no scripture. In this case, he means no Quran at all. Now, this was the situation that the people during the life of Imam Hussein, before he started to stand against this operation, this was the situation the people were going through. Now, what is the role of Imam Hussein in such like a situation?
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and we are talking about a short introduction into how Imam Hussein came into the picture of his life. We're talking about his lifestyle, but indeed, we are here just saying, how was the situation during his time? How was the situation that his people lived during the time that Imam Hussein decided that he will stand against oppressiveness, he will stand against oppressions and the tyrannical rulers of the time? Now, Imam Hussein at the time, he realized that the tyrannical rulers, the rulers who were there, said that they were against the religion, they were against Islam, and they even say that the revelation or the scripture, the Quran, was not there. It's reported from Yazid bin Muawiyah, La'anatullah alayh, when he said, "The Hashemite played are in the rain. Neither any news arrived, nor any revelation descended from the heavens." And also, it's reported from Walid bin Yazid, when he said, "A Hashemite played with the post of caliphate without any revelation or book having revealed on him." Whatever has reached us, if we study it clearly, we will find nothing but disbelief and apostasy, and very few people remained having faith in Allah and the last day, or even very few people have remained who will consider Islam to have any value. Now, without any doubt, not a single portion of the light of Islam had entered their heart. Rather, their souls were already full of bigotry. They were full of ignorance, and not a single quality of disbelief was removed by the force of Islam. They harbored malice, animosity towards the Prophet, and they denied everything that the Messenger had brought as a mercy for all the world. Imam Hussein's work was to make sure that this particular trait, this particular stand, this particular belief goes away, is perished. It's to make sure that people believed in Quran, people believed in the words of the Prophet, and people believed in the world of hereafter, in the last day of judgment. Thank you so much for listening. Until next episode, fi amanillah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
better friends than you. But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
In the limelight.
Times have changed. Russia, China, India, along with many other countries in Asia, the West Asia region, Africa, and South America, are navigating all available spaces to counter the suffocating Western dominance, says Ramzi Barud, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "The Rise of BRICS, the Economic Giant That Is Taking on the West." Stay tuned for more. The G7 summit in Elmau, Germany on June 26 to 28 and the NATO summit in Madrid, Spain 2 days later were practically useless in terms of providing actual solutions to ongoing global crises, the war in Eastern Europe, the looming famines, climate change and more. But the two events were important nonetheless, as they provide a stark example of the impotence of the West amid the rapidly changing global dynamics. As was the case since the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the West attempted to display unity, though it has become repeatedly obvious that no such unity exists. While France, Germany, and Italy are paying a heavy price for the energy crisis resulting from the war, Britain's Boris Johnson is adding fuel to the fire in the hope of making his country relevant on the global stage following the humiliation of Brexit. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is exploiting the war to restore Washington's credibility and leadership over NATO, especially following the disastrous term of Donald Trump, which nearly broke up the historic alliance. Even the fact that several African countries are becoming vulnerable to famines, a result of the disruption of food supplies originating from the Black Sea and the subsequent rising prices, did not seem to perturb the leaders of some of the richest countries in the world. They still insist on not interfering in the global food market, though the skyrocketing prices have already pushed tens of millions of people below the poverty line. Though the West had little reserve of credibility to begin with, Western leaders' current obsession with maintaining thousands of sanctions on Russia, further NATO expansion, dumping yet more lethal weapons in Ukraine, and sustaining their global hegemony at any cost have all pushed their credibility standing to a new low. From the start of the Eastern Europe's crisis, the West championed the same moral dilemma as that raised by George W. Bush at the start of his so-called war on terror. "You're either with us or with the terrorists," he declared in October 2001. But the ongoing Russia-NATO conflict cannot be reduced to simple and self-serving clichés. One can indeed want an end to the war and still oppose U.S.-Western unilateralism. The reason that American diktats worked in the past, however, is that, unlike the current geopolitical atmosphere, a few dared oppose Washington's policies. times have changed. Russia, China, India, along with many other countries in Asia, the West Asia region, Africa and South America are navigating all available spaces to counter the suffocating Western dominance. These countries have made it clear that they will not take part in isolating Russia in the service of NATO's expansionist agenda. To the contrary, they have taken many steps to develop alternatives to the West-dominated global economy, and particularly to the US dollar, which for five decades has served the role of a commodity, not a currency per se. The latter has been Washington's most effective weapon associated with many US orchestrated crises, sanctions, and, as in the case of Iraq and Venezuela, among others, mass hunger. China and others understand that the current conflict is not about Ukraine versus Russia, but about something far more consequential. If Washington and Europe emerge victorious, and if Moscow is pushed back behind the proverbial Iron Curtain, Beijing would have no other options but to make painful concessions to the re-emerging West. This, in turn, would place a cap on China's global economic growth and would weaken its case regarding the One China policy. China is not wrong. Almost immediately following NATO's limitless military support of Ukraine and the subsequent economic war on Russia, Washington and its allies began threatening China over Taiwan. Many provocative statesmen, along with military maneuvers and high-level visits by U.S. politicians to Taipei, were meant to underscore U.S. dominance in the Pacific. Two main reasons drove the West to further invest in the current confrontational approach against China at a time where, arguably, it would have been more beneficial to exercise a degree of diplomacy and compromise. First, the West feared that Beijing could misinterpret its action as weakness and a form of appeasement. And second, because the West's historic relationship with China has always been predicated on intimidation, if not outright humiliation. From the Portuguese occupation of Macau in the 16th century to the British Opium Wars of the mid-19th century to Trump's trade war on China, the West has always viewed China as a subject, not a partner. This is precisely why Beijing did not join the chorus of Western condemnations of Russia. Though the actual war in Ukraine is of no direct benefit to China, the geopolitical outcomes of the war could be critical to the future of China as a global power. While NATO remains insistent on expansion so as to illustrate its durability and unity, it is the alternative world order led by Russia and China that is worthy of serious attention. According to Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, Beijing and Moscow are working to further develop the BRICS club of major emerging economies to serve as a counterweight to the G7. The German newspaper is correct. BRICS' latest summit on June 23rd was designed as a message to the G7 that the West is no longer in the driving seat and that Russia, China, and the Global South are preparing for a long fight against Western dominance. In his speech at the BRICS summit, Russian President Vladimir Putin proposed the creation of an international reserve currency based on the basket of currencies of the countries. The fact that the ruble alone has managed to survive, in fact flourish, under recent Western sanctions gives hope that BRICS currencies combined can manage to eventually sideline the US dollar as the world dominant currency. The global fight ahead is perhaps the most consequential since the Second World War. While NATO will continue to fight for relevance, Russia, China and others will invest in various economic, political and even military infrastructures in the hope of creating a permanent and sustainable counterbalance to Western dominance. The outcome of this conflict is likely to shape the future of humanity.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. Fortunately, Mr. Mohseni, the head of the judiciary, is a faithful revolutionary person. The first point is with regards to the document on fundamental transformation that he talked about. The document on transformation is one of the most progressive documents for change. First, it was prepared, later it was revised during the time of Mr. Raisi. Important points were added and it was completed in that revision. So this document should be acted upon. The esteemed head of the judiciary is committed and he follows up on things. But matters must be followed up on at different levels. Judges, staff and managers must follow up on matters too. But based on the reports that I have received, some are not doing completely the things that one thinks should be done in this area. According to this document, a workforce should be trained. As has been frequently said, personnel need to be trained. Action should be taken in accordance with this document. That is, the judiciary must not be passive in the face of rumours, talk, opposition to it, and the like. There is a straight path in front of it, and it should follow and move along this path with strength. The judiciary should not be influenced by rumours and whether some people like what it has done and some people dislike it. This is the first recommendation.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
My second recommendation is that the issue of fighting corruption should be taken seriously. Corruption exists. Mr. Mohseni told me something good in one of these recent events. He said apparently this is what he meant. That they had decided to first fight corruption within the judiciary itself. Yes, that's a good action to take. It is not true to say that no corruption exists within the judiciary. Of course, the majority of judges are honest, noble, faithful, hard-working, and truly honourable people. There is no doubt about this. But if there are 10 bad people in a group of 1,000 people, they can harm the rest of the group in terms of their reputation, in terms of work and the like. You have to look for those 10 bad people. However, the main task is to confront the structures that bring corruption.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Lebanon's leaders have once more met with the U.S. Energy Envoy, who is in Beirut for talks. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati, and Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri have reportedly given the envoy a unified Lebanese proposal, which the envoy will be taking to the Israeli side for a response. Amos Hochstein told reporters after the meeting that he was optimistic that a demarcation agreement will be reached in the coming weeks.
I remain optimistic that we can make continuous progress as we have over the last several weeks, and I look forward to coming back to the region and being able to make the final arrangement.
This comes one day after Hezbollah's resistance movement released footage of gas barges in the Quraysh field, their coordinates and a surface-to-sea missile, warning the Israelis that wasting time is not beneficial.
The video released by the resistance will strengthen Lebanon's position as a party in the talks and will give the three leaders a new bargaining chip, just like the Hezbollah drones help move the talks forward and bring Hochstein back to Lebanon. The coming hours will be decisive, and we will see realistic steps and will most probably go back to indirect talks in Nahura, but we have very little time.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also repeated that all Hezbollah wants in this file is to help Lebanon and give the state elements of strength in the negotiations.
If we cannot drill and take out our wealth, so nobody else will do. And we are waiting until we see if Hochstein has in his trip to Lebanon any solution to lift off all the sanctions against Lebanon.
Said Nasrallah said in light of the outcome, Hezbollah will decide how to act in the coming period.
Lebanon's President Michel Aoun has stressed that he will not be lenient when it comes to Lebanon's right to its natural resources. He also said he will no longer accept that Lebanon be the subject of discrimination as it has in the past. The statement is backed by what seems to be a new strategy by the resistance, which could give Lebanon the upper hand in the maritime talks. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Prince Charles, Britain's heir to the throne, in yet more hot water for accepting questionable donations to his charitable fund, this time from a family whose name brings back horrifying memories. Bakr and Shafiq bin Laden, wealthy construction magnates and half-brothers of the dead Al-Qaeda terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, reportedly donated $1.7 million to a charitable fund that the prince is the patron of.
The future king allegedly greenlighted the donation after meeting one of the bin Laden brothers in the palatial building known as Clarence House in 2013. only 2 years after U.S. special forces killed a 9/11 mastermind in the east of Pakistan.
The prince's office denies any wrongdoing, saying the decision to accept the money was made by the fund's trustees. To those observing the royal family for years, something bigger is at play.
What I think is happening is, in Britain at the moment, we're in a transition going from the Elizabethan age, if you will, to a new era in the royal family, which is Prince Charles. And I think what they're doing is cleaning out the closet and getting rid of any skeletons which could shadow or cast a shadow over his accession to the throne.
In February, claims of a cash for honor scandal involving a Saudi businessman, a police investigation into another of Charles's charitable foundations ensued. And before that, reports that between 2011 and 2015, the prince accepted donations totaling $3.2 million to his charity from a former Qatari prime minister, with the cash delivered in shopping bags.
The optics aren't good. And if this money was being received in the Kremlin or in Tehran or another country that's at odds with the West, you can imagine the outcry and the pompous invective that would be spouted towards those countries.
It remains to be seen if the prince will be investigated over this latest revelation. And with an upcoming documentary featuring the life of his deceased former wife, Princess Diana, scrutiny of the 73-year-old royal will intensify. Saeed Purza, London.
Under the title Blockade on Yemen, Slow Killing of Civilians under the UN Cover, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in Yemen's capital Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemen despite the UN brokered truce.
The United Nations participates directly and indirectly in the killing of the Yemeni people by its silence on the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. Saudi Arabia is violating the terms of the UN armistice, and unfortunately, the international body has not taken any action. And there are falsification of facts and allegations that the Saudi-led coalition cares about the humanitarian situation in Yemen, and this is not true.
Officials say the United Nations is responsible for the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen throughout the armistice, as it has failed to force Riyadh to fulfill its obligations under the agreement.
The United Nations is the one who monitors and inspects all ships, including food, medicine, and oil ships, but it does not inspect Saudi ships that carry weapons, and all Yemeni ships are prevented from reaching the Hodeidah port. We believe that the United Nations is responsible for what happens to civilians in Yemen because of its inability to force Riyadh to abide by the terms of the armistice brokered by the international body.
Recently, Yemenis have demonstrated in front of the United Nations Envoy's office in Sana'a to criticize Riyadh's continued detention of Yemeni fuel ships amid the UN brokered truce.
Human rights activists believe the Saudi violations of the UN brokered truce will not stop unless the world body takes real measures against the kingdom. They say the terms of the armistice should be completely fulfilled before any extension. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar, is round the corner. Like in other parts of the world, people here in Kashmir, the only Muslim-majority region in India, are also gearing up for annual Muharram ceremonies. Roads and streets are draped with black flags and banners in remembrance of Imam Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his faithful companions who were massacred in the desert plains of Karbala in 680 AD. Painter and calligrapher Shaukat Ahmad is busy these days, preparing banners to be used in mourning rituals. The banners are in huge demand, as they are the integral part of Muharram ceremonies here. The Imam Bargahs, which are congregation halls for Shia commemoration ceremonies, are also being covered with black sheets and banners. The main Muharram commemorations are held in Imam Bargahs, where Kashmiri Marsiyats elegiac poems written to commemorate Imam Hussein and his companions are recited. Also, scholars deliver sermons to highlight the significance of Ashura uprising. Ashura is the 10th